The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
Finished at the 237, which was the mitzvah to not refrain from saving your fellow Jew. Right, we said that any time somebody is in a life-threatening situation, right, you have an obligation to get involved and try to save your fellow Jew if it is at all possible. If you know for a fact that you will be killed in the effort, then you don't. Right, but if there's even a slight chance of saving him, then you have an obligation to get involved because he is, you're only in a situation of doubt. Where he's in a, it's a sure thing. That means by you, it's maybe you will be killed, maybe you won't. He will be for sure be killed if you don't help him, right? But you cannot commit suicide to go and save your fellow Jew.
I have a question, not to stop
you. Yeah, go ahead.
But if you know he's going to be killed, then wouldn't you want to help him then? Versus.
No, if you know you're going to be killed.
Oh, no. If you know he's going to be killed, yes. Well, you would want to help him, especially if he owes you money, right? But we're saying that if you know that you're going to be killed in the effort trying to help him, then the halacha is you're not allowed to commit suicide. It's like, I'll tell you something where there's a perception of an act of heroism where in a war situation, you have a situation where somebody risks his life to save somebody, a soldier is killed, and another soldier risks his life, they risk their lives to recover his body. Right? I'm not sure from a halakhic point of view that that's correct. As a matter of fact, I'm inclined to think it's not correct. Because it may be a very heroic thing. The heroism in Torah is only as good as the Torah recommends. Right? If it's not something that's in keeping with halakha, then it's a false sense of heroism. Right, under certain circumstances, heroism is necessary. Right, the classic example of the Chas HaShalom, the building is burning, and somebody rushes in to save a child, right, or a person, an adult, whoever it is in the building. So you have an obligation to go in. You can't be the commentaries, the halachic commentaries say you can't be too cautious in these areas. Right, that well, look at it, because you always find a way out of it if you're too cautious. On the other hand, if it's absolute suicide, then you have to avoid getting involved. To rush into a burning building, you probably have to make some effort. But if it's going to mean stepping through the fire into the smoke where you haven't got a chance, so then it's futile. At that point, the halacha would not require you to do this.
That's okay. Question.
Yeah, sure.
Why Jew? Why is the situation where it's only you and another Jew? Why wouldn't be any human being?
The Torah in general talks about all the laws in the Torah, the mitzvahs, are always talking about Jew and his fellow Jew, because the hope, the assumption and the hope of the Torah is that that's who we're going to be associating with, right? But not for any hatred of the nations, as opposed to a fear of the nations pulling us down on a spiritual level. That's why there are so many precautions in the Torah, where the Torah says certain mitzvot, where we're not allowed to mix with the nations, not associate with it. That's why certain barriers were created, that we're not allowed to, the whole prohibition of drinking Gentile wine, right? Besides the fact that they might have dedicated it to their idols, right? Let's say they didn't dedicate it to their idols, so what's the problem? There's this whole problem of socializing and integrating, right? Where through socializing and integrating, you're going to end up with the Jewish people being influenced, and eventually, all through history, you just have to look back with hindsight, and you see that when the Jewish people had mixed, what was the result? The result was the Jewish people were pulled down. You know, this week's Parsha, by the way, where it says that when the Egyptians started to panic, when did the Egyptians panic? Right? A new king arises. First of all, very interesting. A new king rises in Egypt. What's the first thing he does? He promulgates some type of decree against the Jews. There's a rallying cry against the Jews. One of the commentaries points out, this Paro was no dummy. This new Paro who arose as a king in Egypt, he knew that when you want to become prominent in a society, what's the sure ticket to prominence? Anti-Semitism, right? Start making noise about Jews. There will always be somebody to jump on your bandwagon. Somebody just asked me yesterday, what about a guy like Farrakhan, right? Because the Gemara says somebody wants to become prominent, make noise against it. Somebody asked, what about a guy named Farrakhan, or what's the guy's name in Russia?
Zhirinovsky,
right. Right. All these people, they're not particular. I mean, they're up there. Somebody asked me yesterday, you know, how come they haven't been succeeded? How come Farrakhan has not yet succeeded? He hasn't been elected as anything, right? The answer is, if not for anti-Semitism, you would never even heard of these people. The only reason you've even heard of them at all is because of anti-Semitism. That means you want to be prominent, you want to rally support for your cause, all you got to do is start picking on Jews. That's what the new paro does. Now, what is it that people are worried about? The Midrash says, you know what the Jews were doing? The Jews filled the feeders in the land. And that's when the anti-Semitism began. What does it mean to fill the feeders?
Social problems?
I think so. Yeah, I think the Jews came out of their ghetto, they started integrating, assimilating into the society. Filling the theaters may mean they took over the Hollywood of Egypt, yeah. Right? Like they're taking over the Hollywood in America. They probably ran all the Egyptian movies in cinema where, you know, we're all Jew run, you know, produced by Yankel Katz, right? And, you know, starring a bunch of Egyptian movie stars, but the writer, director, and the owner of the theater and the owner of the network, they were all Jews, right? But the idea is that they spilled out, they integrated. Where were they to begin in the beginning? The Jews were in a ghetto. I mean, the Jews were in Goshen. Goshen was a ghetto, right? As long as they were in a ghetto, nobody was particularly fond of them. But they were okay. When they spilled out from the ghetto and they started mixing and mingling into society, that's when the trouble starts. All right. So when the Torah talks about Jews, right? What about a non-Jew? You're not allowed to go around. Do you have to risk your life to save a non-Jew? That I don't know. I don't think that you have the same obligation as a Jew. But remember, there's a difference because a Jew is your family member and a non-Jew is not. Right? We're talking about families over here. So you have certain loyalties. Same. Remember, we're speaking about the laws of charity. How you have loyalties to your family members first, right? And the Jews are your family members. It has nothing to do with a hatred of non-Jews. It has to do with where are your first loyalties to. We are not the idea of, were you at Kiddush Friday night? Right? You were everybody with the main Kiddush Friday night? Right? At whatever Shabbos table you were at, did you protest?
No, I don't ever protest.
You didn't protest. Did any of you protest? Right? At the Kiddush you were at Friday night, somebody making Kiddush said, Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim, you chose us from among all nations. Right? So there are one of two assumptions. If you didn't know what they were saying in Hebrew, right, well then you better wonder what they're saying. Who knows what they may be talking to each other about you, right? And if you did know what they're saying and you didn't protest, that means you're agreeing. Your silence is a sign of agreement. Right? That means you have agreed with some guy getting up, taking a cup of wine, and making a statement. You chose us above all nations. And then what did you do? You spent the next 2 hours eating and celebrating that fact, right? You guys are bigger racists than I am. Right? You're racist, right? You didn't protest? That's agreement. And you did. I didn't see any of you avoid the food. No, I can't partake of a celebration. We're celebrating our chosenness. The answer is that we're chosen. We're chosen and we're different. We have a different role. Therefore, we relate to ourselves. We have our own family. We are an elitist family. And we have our responsibilities to our family members first. And the Torah always speaks of Re'acha and your fellow Jew and so on and so forth.
I guess it's when I think of life and death, I mean, I was actually involved in a situation this year where someone was in a life or death situation. And as a human being, when you see someone in that situation, it wouldn't matter to me if it's a Jew or non-Jew. You think you have an obligation to save that person. And
That
wouldn't come into your head.
You certainly have an obligation to save him. If he's a non-Jew, you certainly have an obligation to save him. The question is if you have an obligation to risk your life to save him. There's a difference between the two, right? Then you get into saving on Shabbos and so on and so forth. But there's the whole point of the Torah is that we're not governed by our emotions. You're right. We have certain emotional responses, right? But the whole Torah, the theme of the Torah, is that we're not governed by our emotions, right? There are some mitzvahs which are very disturbing to the emotions. And you have to send away the mother bird, or sometimes you have to kill certain people under certain circumstances. Right? But we can't be governed by the emotions. Yeah.
Yeah, how do you reconcile the concept of Or LeGoyim, or light unto other nations, if you have all these prohibitions and restrictions? I mean, if there is no relationship between the Jewish world and the world at large, how can...
That's very good. The point is that what do we have to do to be an Or LeGoyim? How do you become a light to the other nations? You don't have to mix in with the other nations to be light. To the contrary, the other nations see you. Right? The other nations, the Jews have always had a reputation among nations of the world without mixing in. The Jews are the people of the book, right? The other nations know. Do you know that when one of the most ridiculous, ludicrous news items to ever go international, right? Something that cannot be explained by normal laws of nature. In this country, about, I don't know, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago, I don't remember when, there was a problem because there were certain advertisers that were putting out these not sneeze posters advertising certain products. So certain religious extremists, it wasn't even shown to be religious extremists, but there were certain people who resented these advertisements being placed on these bus stops. They were being put on the bus stop, and there were accused, supposedly religious Jews, who were never found, they never found the culprits. Supposedly, though, it was religious Jews were burning down bus stops to protest the posters being placed there by these advertising companies, right? These non-sneeze posters, right? So there was a series of bus stops that were burned down. I don't remember, maybe 3, 4, 5 bus stops were burned down. And every time one of them was burned down, it made the headlines here in Yerushalayim. It was big news in Israel, right? Do you know that the burning of the bus stops went international? And it made British newspapers, right? Bus stops are being burned in Israel. Let me ask you a question. If you compare it to other newsworthy items, if they were burning bus stops in New York, right, there'd be celebrations in the street. That's all that would happen in New York. They only burned bus stops. Right? How does that compare to murder and all the other crimes? A crime of burning a bus stop, that becomes international news. Why? Because it was an ultra-Orthodox Jew that did it, which means what? The rest of the world is looking at the ultra-Orthodox Jew and saying, you're not supposed to be doing that. We expect more from you. Why? Because you are a light to the nations. And your lifestyle, everything about your lifestyle, is something that the nations look at, the nations take a let, the nations are able to. That's why there's always much more expectation of the Jews. That's why even Israel, which is not a Torah observant country, there's more of an expectation of Israel by the other nations that Israel is going to abide by certain moral standards. Because after all, you're Jews, we expect more from you. So if Jews live the way they're supposed to, even though they're in their self-contained ghettos, that becomes a light to the nations. We don't have to go and mingle with them. We don't have to give them shiurim out in Brigham Young University, right, to teach them. All we have to do is we have to live our life a certain way, and they'll learn from our example. That's the light unto the nations. But it was absolutely ridiculous. The burning of the bus stops. Right? They put it in a proper perspective. It was hysterical, right? I mean, they never caught. By the way, they never found that it was. They never found it was an Orthodox Jew. Like, there was even speculation that it was being done by secular people dressed up as Orthodox in order to frame the, which has been done. Right, so. Okay. 238 is the prohibition of hating a fellow Jew in your heart. Right, that means you are not allowed to hate your fellow Jew in your heart. Open hatred is prohibited also. Not to mistake this as, oh good, right? I'm not allowed to hate people in my heart, but if I go openly and hate people, that's quite all right, right? The truth of the matter is you're not supposed to hate people openly either. But if there is a certain form of resentment, if somebody does dislike somebody else, then the halacha is that you are not allowed to keep it in your heart. Yosef's brothers, who hated Yosef, the Chumash says openly, they hated him. They couldn't even greet him. They couldn't say shalom to him. Imagine Yosef, he's got 11 brothers, he comes to the breakfast table, right? Morning, guys, right? They're looking at him. They couldn't even answer him, right? They're silenced, right? That's what I mean, lo yachlu davar l'shalom. They couldn't answer, and the Torah, in criticizing them, tells over their praises. I mean, the Torah says that in spite of the fact that they were wrong for hating him, at least when they hated him properly. There was no mistake in Yosef's mind that the brothers hated him. Yosef knew that they hated him. To keep the hatred in your heart, and then to be what they call two-faced, in Hebrew it's called, in the Gemara terminology, called tsevuim. You know the word tsevua means in Hebrew? Litzboa is tsefa, is a color. Tsevuim means your color, your two-faced, right? To hate someone in your heart, and then show openly that you don't hate him, that's being two-faced, right? So if a person wants to be true to himself, if there's somebody that you dislike, you have an obligation to let him know it. Right? Now, obviously, it's got to be done. We're going to talk about rebuking in a second. But to hate somebody in your heart is worse than to hate somebody openly. Ideally, ideally, one should not hate, if possible, one should not hate at all. And the way to avoid hating people is by doing what? Somebody you dislike or somebody you hate. How do you avoid it? How do you overcome it?
Do them a favor.
Do something for them. Correct. Right. Try to do something for people. If you're somebody you dislike, the fastest way to like somebody is by doing something for him. There's a there's a natural breakdown in the barriers if you try to help somebody. That's why the Torah, when the command of helping somebody unload his donkey, if you see two people, one is your enemy and one is your friend, who you're supposed to help. Just help your enemy, because that will hopefully break that animosity.
Okay, so you do something nice for the person you hate. Okay, granted, you feel maybe temporarily more positive than negative about it. But then again, you would have to do it again and again, because every time you see this person, you're not going to initially like this person.
Correct. The more you invest, the more it's going to develop. You're absolutely correct. Right? On the other hand, if you don't start somewhere, it's never going to happen. But as soon as you start, and once you start, and once you keep investing energy, that's the nature of any type of relationship. The more you invest in a relationship, the more you like that person. Obviously, it can sour.
Right. If
the person takes advantage of you, you're not going to be very fond of you. At a certain point, you're going to get tired of them. But very often, our hatred for people, or our resentment, or our dislike for people, very often it's unfounded. You don't like somebody, you just don't like the way he looks. Right? Or you don't like the way somebody walks. You don't like the way somebody, you don't like somebody's accent. It happens all the time. Right? You don't like somebody's accent, right? You don't like somebody's clothing, right? Then as soon as you do something for them, it's unreasonable. As soon as you do something, or all of a sudden you see that he's not such a bad guy after all. So on and so forth. Okay, now the next mitzvah. Okay.
Well, then, because I'm still trying to figure it out. Like, just recently, I was on a tour with somebody, with a bunch of people, and I got some flowers for this certain person. He says, I didn't really like this person. I figured if I'm nice enough to this person, then maybe things will look out a little different. And then, like, the next time I met him, it's the same thing all over again. But I didn't invest any more in him. I just, like, basically went my way instead of, like, investing.
Choice you made. It's your own choice. If you would have invested more, then the natural relationship is nurtured even further. Obviously, it takes two to tango. Right, but to break down that initial animosity, it requires an act of God. Okay, let's go on. 239 is the mitzvah to rebuke your fellow Jew. This is the one that everybody loves, this mitzvah. The mitzvah to rebuke, there are two mitzvahs everybody loves. Is getting drunk on Purim, right, which everybody abides by, right, even if it's not Purim, right, we're so stringent and so frum. Even when we begin early, right? Purim is the one-day holiday which we make last 7 days, and the seven-day holidays we condense into one, right? Well, this is the next one. Next one is rebuking your fellow Jew. I said to somebody, it's one of the signs that Moshe Rabbeinu is Jewish, right? Because the first day out of the palace, he starts rebuking Jews, right? There's his Jewish nature coming out. Immediately, these new guys starts rebuking them. Oh, Moshe Rabbeinu is a Jew like the rest of them. Right? The mitzvah to rebuke your fellow Jew. Now, first of all, let's qualify this before we go around correcting the world. First of all, you are not allowed to cause embarrassment to the person whom you are rebuking, even if nobody else is around. Right? That means that when you are going to tell somebody off, you must tell somebody off in a way where you are not going to hurt their feelings. Now, it's very difficult to tell somebody off without hurting their feelings, right? One way or another, nobody likes to receive criticism. No one. Nobody I know, yes, please criticize me, right? Like, I hear people talking, it's like, wow, I really hate getting ripped off, right? If there's one thing I hate, it's getting ripped off. You know, frankly, I have never met anybody who is into getting ripped off, right? Nobody likes getting ripped off, right? The same way, nobody likes being rebuked. Right? Nobody likes being told that they're a fool. We all like to live with an illusion that we are pretty much close to or on the road to perfection in all ways. And nobody likes to be told that, you know, the Gemara says a person sees everybody's flaws except his own. Right? Everyone's flaws. I could tell you, I could sit down with every one of you, even if I've never met you before. Sit down with every one of you, give me 5 minutes, and I'll come up with a whole list of your flaws. My flaws? Non-existence, right? I've been perfect for many, many years. Right? the truth of the matter is, nobody likes to be rebuked, right? Now, the first requirement is that when you do rebuke somebody, you're not allowed to make them feel bad. The test for yourself, somebody once said, if you ever feel like rebuking somebody, that's the best time not to do it. The worst time to rebuke somebody is when you feel like rebuking him. Oh, I'm going to tell him off, right? Why? You got a load you want to get off. You got some steam that has to get out. That's the worst time to tell somebody off. Then you know that the rebuke is not coming out of love. There, the rebuke is coming out of resentment or out of the need to get even. Now, there's a benefit to rebuking people. And that is that if you do have a personal vendetta against somebody, the only way you're going to get rid of it is by telling him off, right? If it brings out, by talking it out, it brings it out of your heart. Now, you have to be very careful over here, because sometimes you're not going to make a lot of friends. You're not going to be a successful human being and make friends and keep friends if you make a career out of rebuking people and telling people off. It should be done sparingly, only under those circumstances where it's absolutely necessary. But when it is necessary, that means every time I see you, you got to the point where every time I see you, I have a certain resentment against you building up for something you've done to me. At that point, I must tell you off. At that point, I must get things out in the open and let you know that there's a problem between us. By doing that, by talking it out, that brings it out of the heart. Now, there are two types of rebuke, and it's very important. There's somebody who has wronged you, somebody who's done anything wrong to you, and somebody who is doing averas. That means somebody who is sinning and has no effect on you, in the physical world anyway, has no effect on you, yet you have an obligation to correct your fellow Jew. We are all responsible for each other, right? You understand the difference between the two. There's one where you've wronged me, therefore I have to correct you. There's another one where you're doing an avera and I also have to correct you. So here, the halacha splits. If it's somebody who should know better, then you know what extent you must go to in order to correct him. You have to correct him until he gets to the point where he's going to hit you. That means until he gets to the point that he's going to strike you, you must continue rebuking him. You must continue telling him off. That's if it's somebody who knows better, right? If it's somebody who is not going to listen to you at all, or somebody, a classic example of somebody who's never been exposed to Torah and doesn't know what he's supposed to be doing, under those circumstances, you don't have to rebuke at all. And if you feel that you're not able to tell somebody off without hurting his feelings, then you're also exempt from rebuke. Rabbi Chaim Volozhin was a disciple of the Vilna Gaon. Rabbi Chaim Volozhin never rebuked people. He exempted himself from the mitzvah of rebuking because he felt he could not fulfill all the criteria. The criteria being that you can only rebuke if you are not going to make somebody feel bad. And the Gemara says that nowadays, none of us know how to rebuke. None of us know how to give rebuke. None of us know how to take rebuke. None of us know how to take criticism. I told you, if you ever do have to criticize, you always start off with a compliment. Right? Criticism should always begin with a compliment. And then, because you've started with a compliment, the person that you're trying to criticize will become much more receptive. That works for everybody except whom? Your wife. Right. The rule by a wife is, when you do criticize, you must first give a gift, then lots of compliments, then, before you criticize, change your mind and don't criticize. Right? Because if you do, you're going to end up in trouble anyway. No matter what it's for, no matter what the circumstances are, don't criticize. Right? If something has to be worked out, though, you have no choice. Right? You must tell you, but take her out to dinner first. Right? Take her out to dinner, buy her a gift, then humbly on both knees. Tell her what needs to be changed, and hope for the best. And prayer helps. They laugh. See how much you're laughing, guys. You guys will see how much you're laughing after the first time you criticize your wife. I remember a guy telling me how he made his wife cry so often the first year they were married. Right, he comes to me, and it happens, right? But the women are extremely sensitive to criticism. Right? Women are extremely, especially from the husband, because their whole goal, their entire goal in life, is that their husband should view them as being this perfect creature. And any type of criticism implies any type of fault or deficiency that you're implying in them it practically shatters their goal. Their goal is that their husband should admire them. If you're criticizing, it means that there's obviously something about them that you're not admiring. Right? And it's shattered for a woman. For a man, it's a bruised ego. Right? A man's ego is bruised. Men have bigger egos than women. So for a woman, it's not a bruised ego. It's a tearing down of her entire emotional makeup. Right? And for a woman, it's devastating. Okay. Number 240. Is the prohibition, by the way, you know the story of the Chafetz Chaim, there was a traveling preacher who came to town by the Chafetz Chaim, and he was one of these fire and brimstone preachers, right? So he took the pulpit and the shul, and he gave the people a good fiery musar shmuz, you know, he really let them have it for about an hour, he really let them have it, Gehenna, and they're burning, and all, right, gave it to them good, right? Came to the Chafetz Chaim afterwards, he said to the Chafetz Chaim, you know what? I gave them this Musar Shmuz. I don't think they really accepted. I just don't have this feeling that they were very receptive. So the Chafetz Chaim said to him, when you gave them the Musar, when you gave them the Rebuk, did you yell? He said, oh, did I ever? Boy, did I yell. I really let them have it. So the Chafetz Chaim said, let me ask you a question. Did you put on tefillin today? Tefillin? Of course. Me? Of course I put on tefillin. The Chafetz Chaim said, when you put on tefillin today, did you yell? I looked at the Chafetz Chaim and says, why would I yell when I put on my tefillin? The Chafetz Chaim says, why would you yell when you're giving them the rebuke? That means it's a mitzvah to rebuke people. Who said you have to yell when you rebuke? Right? When you rebuke, the rebuking is supposed to be out of love. Fire and brimstone doesn't work very well. Right? All fire and brimstone breeds is counter fire and brimstone. Right? So the mitzvah is that it's got to be done. It's got to come from the heart, not to be some type of a yell. Okay, 240, to not embarrass someone, the prohibition of embarrassing. If you embarrass somebody publicly, and I think publicly in this context means in front of three people, not in front of 10 people. There are two types of public in Torah. There's public meaning a minion of people, a group of people which is normally 10 people, and there is three people who you, if you embarrass somebody in front of three people, you lose your portion in the world to come, and not a big deal. It could be recovered if you apologize. Right? If you apologize, you can recover. But be aware that that is the severity. The severity of embarrassing somebody publicly is that you lose your portion in the world to come. The only one who's allowed to do is a Rebbe who's allowed to embarrass his disciples.
If it feels between embarrassing someone and making a joke.
No. The answer is no. The answer is that those jokes, what you're saying is very important because it's those jokes, right? There are two types. There's vicious embarrassment where I really want to humiliate him publicly, and there's where we play a practical joke on somebody and embarrass him publicly. Both end up with there's vicious Gehenna. And there's practical joke gang. Right? They both end up in the same place. If it's among friends, and you embarrass somebody among friends, so then you had them, those friends all sit together. Yes, no, the halachas of embarrassing people are very much like the halachas of Lashon Hara. You're not allowed to speak Lashon Hara about friends either. Right? Practical jokes, unless you know for a fact that the guy is going, that the person on the receiving end doesn't mind. Right, and most people who you assume don't mind. Right? Sometimes people are good sports about something because they're expected to be good sports. But if in their heart there's resentment, then the person who put them in that situation is in trouble. Okay, so just a couple of examples: any type of nicknames. You embarrass somebody by using any type of nicknames or any type of embarrassing tricks. Right, any type of embarrassing tricks or putting people on the spot, right? This happens in life all the time, where suddenly somebody is singled out for something, right? And under the circumstances, all of a sudden you feel like all eyes are on you and you're not prepared for it, that's embarrassing, right? So anything, you know, the surprise party. Some people hate surprise parties, right? I don't, guys. I like surprise parties, by the way. But there are people that hate surprise parties, right? And when there's a surprise party, right, they feel everybody's looking at them. Now, if somebody wants to ask me, what about praising somebody? Right? What if you take somebody walks into the room and says, gentlemen, the greatest man on earth. And the guy's just absolutely embarrassed. I think that there's a different type of embarrassment.
right? It's a type of embarrassment where you're kind of embarrassed, but it's kind of like, you know, keep on going, right? That type of embarrassment. It's a little humiliating. It's like, I wasn't ready for this, but now that you've started, don't stop the embarrassment. I think that's different than a humiliation type of embarrassment. Right? But if you know that somebody does not like attention, somebody does not want to be the center of the party, somebody does not want to surprise her, then it also would be wrong to do such a thing. Okay? But any type of embarrassment, embarrassment is a, it's an example. To be embarrassed, everybody, I'm sure we've all been embarrassed at some point or time or other in our life. We've all been embarrassed, right? Embarrassment is an example of a certain type of non-physical suffering, right? That means that it's not pain, it's not physical pain, but it is a form of suffering that if we ever wonder how bad could Gehenna be, how bad could it be, when we talk about burning in Gehenna, how bad could it be? Just think back to some point where you've been embarrassed or some embarrassing situation. Try to relive that feeling, right? And then...
Please turn the tape to the other side.